If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Wednesday, January the 20th, Inauguration Day in America, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining politics and policy during the presidency of Donald Trump and now the presidency of Joe Biden. I'm Bill Whalen. I'm a research fellow here at the Hoover Institution, as well as the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism. Before we get to our guest today, a housekeeping matter. This is the last Area 45 podcast, as just a very short while ago, Joe Biden became the 46th president. We're still doing podcasts here at the Hoover Institution. This podcast will continue as well. It's just it's going to be under a new title with maybe a slightly different direction. We're going to go a little more local and a little more global, which I think pleases my guest today. This being our last podcast under the guise of Area 45, I wanted to go out in style, and that's what we're doing today. We have a very special guest, and that is Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster. General McMaster is the Hoover Institution's Fuad Michelle Ajami Senior Fellow. He was the 26th Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs. For 34 years, he served his country as a commissioned officer in the United States Army. General McMaster is a graduate of West Point and holds a PhD in military history from UNC Chapel Hill. But wait, there's more. He's also the author of the New York Times bestseller, Battlegrounds, The Fight to Defend the Free World. Battlegrounds is also the title of interviews with world leaders that General McMaster does on behalf of the Hoover Institution. Finally, HR is one of the three Hoover Goodfellows who appear on the weekly Hoover Institution broadcast that I have the good fortune to moderate. HR, thank you ever so much for being on part of this, the last Area 45 podcast.
Hey, Bill, it's a real honor, and I really appreciate what you've done with this podcast to inform the American people about the critical issues that we've confronted during the Trump administration. I'm gonna miss it, and look forward to the next version of your podcast.
Thanks, HR. I appreciate that. So let's start today by talking about what's going on at the White House, literally as we're doing this. And I will point out to the audience that it's a little after 10 o'clock. On the West Coast. The new president spoke about an hour ago, which means, HR, that as we speak, people are populating and have been populating the White House, repopulating the White House, I guess. That includes a fellow named Jake Sullivan, who is the answer to the trivia question of who is Joe Biden's new national security advisor. Let me point out to the audience that this is a very select club by Washington standards. As I mentioned, that you, HR, were the 25th national security advisor. Sullivan is the 28th. Your boss and mine, Condoleezza Rice, the director of the Hoover Institution, was the 19th. So this is a pretty small club. You should be proud to be part of it. Let's start, HR, by why don't you tell me that when Mr. Sullivan walks into the Eisenhower building, into the NSC offices, the National Security Council, what's the first order of business? Does he call a meeting and sit down and just talk about what they're doing? How do you kind of start from zero with an operation like that?
Well, you know, Bill, it's a great job. You know, and I was really grateful for the opportunity to do it. I think there are really five critical tasks you have as a national security advisor, and he'll do, I think, some of these, you know, in those first 24 hours. And he's probably been working on this already, you know, during the transition. The first is, you know, you have to staff the president, right? The national security advisor is the only person in the national security and foreign policy establishment who has the president as his or her only client. And so you have to prepare the president for all of his engagements, his phone calls with foreign leaders. And of course, you know, to get the president kind of up to speed on the biggest issues and challenges and opportunities that we face internationally, and begin to help the president decide, you know, what his foreign policy agenda is going to be. And then help him begin to implement that agenda as the cabinet and his other appointees are coming together as a team. The second thing that you have to do is run a process, right? Run a process that I think ideally delivers options to the president, options that are oriented on the most significant challenges and opportunities that we face internationally. And then of course, assists with the sensible implementation of the president's decisions and policies. The third thing that you have to do as a national security advisor is communicate the president's direction and decisions across the government. And of course, the teams aren't in place for this new administration within the departments and agencies. So that's an important task, right? Is to begin to let the long-term civil servants know, hey, this is the direction the president wants to take. And then sometimes you have to communicate to other audiences as well, maybe the public, but I think a national security advisor should be in the background, right? more than you know, on the Sunday shows and so forth, or in the briefing room. And then you know, the other key task is to ensure unity of effort with like-minded countries, allies and partners. So he'll be on the phone, you know, he'll be talking to his foreign counterparts for sure, if he hasn't already. And to, you know, to make introductions if he doesn't know them already, or to rekindle, you know, their relationships. And I think it's important to listen to them as well, you know, and to ask them, hey, what is your advice? What would you like to see from U.S. foreign policy standpoint and so forth? That's a big opportunity. Those initial calls to your counterparts, and sometimes you call if you know heads of state, you can, you know, call them and so forth and begin to hear from them and then relay that to the president. And then finally, and this is an important task, Bill, is that you have to be a leader of an organization, right? The National Security Council staff. And you have to provide them with what we, you know, we say in the military, purpose, motivation, and direction, right? And you know, you're going to have a lot of members of that staff who are there now. Those are the civil servants that rotate in from the departments and the agencies. Some people would call this the deep state, but these are civil servants who are dedicated to the service of their country, and they're committed to the transition of power and the results of the election. And so I think it's important for him to meet them. To convene them, whatever is the most appropriate time, mm-hmm. and then to share with them how he intends to best serve the president, and how they're, you know, he envisions them working together,
right.
to run the process and develop the options that I mentioned as part of that process.
You entered the job HR under kind of unusual circumstances. Your first day was February 2017. So the administration was already underway. So there was an operation, but you had to get in and kind of get up to, how long did it take you to get up to speed when you first came in? I mean, to take just hours, days, weeks to kind of feel comfortable in the job?
Well, you know, Bill, I had this tremendous gift that the Army gave me, which was to go to graduate school full time and to study history. And I chose for my dissertation topic, really, you know, to try to explain how and why Vietnam became an American war, how those decisions were made,
which you ended up writing a book on.
I wrote a book on this topic, and so, you know, I had his knowledge from a historical perspective of the national security decision making process, and especially, you know, pitfalls in that process associated with how and why Vietnam became an American war. So, and I had taught this topic as well, you know, at West Point. So I thought, you know, hey, this is an opportunity for me to at least try not to make the same mistakes that I wrote about. Right? So I had an idea. I had an idea coming in about, you know, these five, you know, critical responsibilities for a national security advisor, how I intended to discharge those responsibilities and to serve the president hopefully well. And then, you know, I met with some friends, you know, on my way in. I mean, as you mentioned, there's no transition time, right? I mean, I got a call when I was visiting my hometown of Philadelphia on a Friday. I was in Mar-a-Lago for, you know, for the interview on a Sunday. The president hired me on Monday of President's Day weekend. I flew back with him on Air Force One. They then flew me in these Marine Osprey aircraft back to my house to pack a bag and fly right. back the next day and start. So I started Tuesday afternoon, you know. So, but it was a real gift to have studied the process. And so when I convened the National Security Council staff, you know, got them together for an all hands meeting, mm-hmm. I think on Wednesday or Thursday, but within 48 hours, you know, then I laid out for that staff how I envisioned us working together to best serve the president, you know, and then we put in place a process that I think did serve him well in those 13 months when I was in the job, and allowed us to put in place a national security strategy and underlying strategies, one of which, Bill, was just declassified about a week ago, which was the Indo-Pacific strategy. So I think we got a lot of good work done together as a team in an environment, as you know, that transition was not like super smooth, right? And there was, right. you know, there were leaks and we forget, right? The resistance movement, you know, to Donald Trump and so it was a vitriolic partisan atmosphere like we've experienced recently, not maybe to the extreme of, you know, storming of the Capitol like we saw, but it was maybe a difficult environment, but, you know, hey, you know, I believe, you know, in a degree of stoicism, I think you get that from, you know, from combat experience. And so I was just, hey, bring it on, right? Let's just get the job done.
So foreign policy HR got really kind of scant mention, passing mention in the president's inaugural. Not a surprise since the theme was unity, and pandemic is obviously going to define the early stages of his presidency, and he wants to bring the country together, which is a decidedly domestic focus. So let's talk about the world. Simple question, HR. Does Joe Biden inherit a safer world or a more dangerous world than the one Donald Trump walked into in January 2017? Is the world more complicated, less complicated? How would you describe it?
Yeah, you know, I think it's more dangerous and more complicated, Bill. And the reason is, you know, that we've experienced, I think, these traumas that affect us and our ability to compete effectively. And, you know, these are kind of the quadruple traumas we've been through of a pandemic, a recession associated with a pandemic, the social divisions and unrest and violence that followed the murder of George Floyd. And then, of course, you know, this vitriolic partisan season that we are still, you know, hopefully about to get beyond at this point. And so, you know, I think that that the world's more dangerous in part because we've been so distracted and divided as well. Mm-hmm. But I think COVID-19 globally has, instead of suspended critical competitions that are critical to our security, our prosperity, our influence in the world, I think instead the pandemic has catalyzed those competitions. And emboldened, for example, the Chinese Communist Party. You know, you see the actions that the party's taken with massive cyber attacks and bludgeoning of Indian soldiers on the Himalayan frontiers. You know, the increased aggression in the South China Sea. You know, this wolf warrior diplomacy, the threats to Taiwan. You know, the economic coercion of Australia. You know, so I mean, you could go on, right? But so I think that it's more dangerous from a great power competition standpoint. I think you see Putin as well. Who appears to be more desperate, more paranoid, maybe about the potential loss of power with the poisoning and now the arrest of Navalny and the massive cyber attacks that have just been revealed on our country from Russia. So from a great power competition, more dangerous. We know that North Korea is not suspended, even though the North Korean regime, I think, this the only hereditary communist dictatorship in the world is under duress from COVID-19 and from the you know the effect on the you know the whatever passes for an economy there, right. but they haven't suspended the missile program or the nuclear program, so that's still a grave threat to the world. Iran, as we've seen, has been very bold in enriching uranium beyond the degree that was the limitations in this, you know, this weak Iran nuclear deal. And has not diminished its support for militias and terrorist organizations across the greater Middle East. So these hostile states are a threat. And I want to say, hey, Bill, I think that the threat from jihadist terrorism is much greater today because of the alumni, the ISIS and Al Qaeda alumni, and other groups who are orders of magnitude larger than they have been in the past with more access to more and more destructive capabilities and our disengagement from some of these contests. You know, I think it was a big mistake. I mean, why did we pull 700 soldiers out of Somalia, right? I mean, 700 soldiers who actually had a huge impact on ensuring that Al-Shabaab, a very dangerous organization that's determined to commit mass murder on our soil, could not gain the strength necessary to make good on that objective. And then also that I think this abhorrent approach to Afghanistan as well. So, hey, I think it's more dangerous. We see that in cyberspace, certainly, and in other contested domains.
Okay. Going back to Herbert Hoover, HR, former presidents have built libraries to showcase their accomplishments in office. One has to get one's head around the concept of a Trump library, beginning with a god-awful fight over where it will be. Remember, there's a fight here at Stanford over a Reagan library way back when, so these things can be very controversial. But let's assume, for the sake of argument, there is a Trump library at some point, and let's assume that there is a foreign policy wing within the Trump library. And I'm going to task you with designing that foreign policy wing. What would you showcase for accomplishments? And I'm going to throw three things at you. One is confronting China. The second one is the Abraham Accords. And the third one, and I'm not sure how you would do this without having a lot of horrible visuals, but that's the killing of Soleimani. So what's on the greatest hits album of Trump foreign policy?
Well, Bill, I think you've hit three of the real highlights of it, right? I think that the shift from an approach of, and these labels aren't particularly useful, but the approach of cooperation and engagement with China under the mistaken assumption, the false assumption that China, having been welcomed into the international order, would play by the rules, would liberalize its economy, and as it prospered, would liberalize its form of governance. The shift from that approach to an approach of transparent competition that all Americans now have accessible to them because of the declassification of the Indo-Pacific strategy that our team worked on. Matt Pottinger, who will be joining the great Hoover team here soon as a visiting fellow, did a tremendous job with the Indo-Pacific strategy and with that shift in the approach to China. I think that was the most significant shift in foreign policy, as I mentioned, since the end of the Cold War, and it was long overdue. And I think that will be an element of continuity across multiple administrations. The second that you mentioned, the Abraham Accords, I think is also immensely important. And the reason that's important is because it removes a source of ideological support for jihadist terrorist organizations. These are terrorists who try to justify their criminal acts using mass murder as their principal tactic in a war against all humanity by casting their actions as part of a war of religion or a war against, you know, the Zionist crusader conspiracy and so forth. So I think normalizing relations with Israel has tremendous potential for breaking the cycle of sectarian violence across the Middle East, and of course weakening Iran's influence, and leading to a recognition that Iran's support for militias and the continuation of their four-decade-long proxy war against not only the great Satan, you know, us, the little Satan Israel, but also the Arab monarchies, is one of the greatest threats to security and the principal cause, really, of this humanitarian catastrophe in the Middle East. And that can be built upon. And you know what, Bill? That goes back to the first days of the Trump administration when President Trump traveled to Riyadh. Remember, people were saying, what the heck is Donald Trump doing going to Saudi Arabia, right? And remember that trip went to really the centers of the world's greatest religions, right? he went from Saudi Arabia to Israel and then to Rome. And I think if you read his speech that maybe was a bit too long, I think you would agree, Bill, based on your speech writing background and expertise. And I tried to cut it down a little bit, but it was a profoundly positive speech. And what's really important then is to read King Salman's speech. I think it was a profound shift in the thinking of the Saudi royal family. Right now, we have to make sure they make good on that, and we continue to work together on reducing the source of ideological support for terrorists. But I think that's a big, profoundly positive aspect of the legacy of Trump and his foreign policy.
Did that work because it was simple as the Trump administration splitting away the Israel-Palestinian question from the other matter and actually pointing out to Israel and the UAE and the Saudis that they have two things in common? One is economic growth, and the second is their shared concern about Iran. Yeah. Is that kind of the story to the success with the Abraham Accords?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of the story. The other part of the story is they just came to this conclusion themselves, obviously, that, hey, yeah, the biggest threat to them is from the RGC, and this is what your third aspect of this question asks is the killing of Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas January 6th of last year. And so I think there was already an alignment. I mean, I think, this is, I don't want to overstate this, but I think that the UAE and Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, I think they realized, hey, that their security interests are aligned with those of Israel. And actually, I think the Abraham Accord was motivated in part by a fear of U.S. disengagement from the region, right? I mean, what we keep shooting ourselves in the foot in the Middle East, right? Because we keep saying, hey, we're leaving. Well, we never really leave, right? We don't want to have vast numbers of troops there, certainly. But we want to remain engaged, right? Because we have significant interests in the Middle East. And so, but every time we say we're going to leave, then countries in the region hedge their bets, right? They hedge their bets by giving Russia, a free ride, even though that it's enabling, the serial episodes of mass homicide, which are the Syrian civil war, right? And also they hedge, I think, in this case, by kind of aligning with Israel, because the IDF, if we disengage, the Israeli Defense Force, might be the best, guarantors of security in the region facing the Iranian threat. And again, the sustained proxy war that the RGC has been running. The other legacy, I think, for the Trump administration is that this very significant shift toward Iran. And I think that, we abandoned, I think, this conciliatory approach to Iran that the Obama administration pursued. It was actually an approach to Iran that has been present across multiple administrations, this conciliatory approach to Iran. Mm-hmm. And I think the idea was, hey, it forced them to make a choice, right? I mean, force the Iranian regime, the Supreme Leader, the Guardian Council, the RGC, hey, you can either be treated like a normal nation and be welcomed to the international community, or you can continue your proxy war against us and suffer the consequences of isolation. And I hope the Biden administration will continue that. I don't think they're going to. I think they're nostalgic for 2016 and the Iran nuclear deal, want to turn the clock back. I don't think it's going to work, right? I don't think it's going to work. So I think what was important about the Qasem Soleimani strike was it communicated to the Iranians, hey, no matter what you do through proxy forces, we know what the return address is for violence against us. And I think Americans have to recognize they had just organized an assault on our embassy. And Qasem Soleimani was in the middle of a regional tour making plans to conduct further attacks against us. So I think it was the righteous use of violence against somebody who has, I think had more blood on his hands than anyone else in the Middle East. And that's a high standard.
HR, in retrospect, a good idea or a bad idea for the president to meet with Kim Jong-un?
Well, hey, Bill, as I write Battlegrounds, it was going to happen. President Trump wasn't going to pass up this opportunity, right? This is going to be a must see episode in the reality TV show of the Trump administration, right? So I think what was important is that the administration did not let up on maximum pressure. What I was concerned about is that the effort to convince Kim Jong-un that he's safer without the weapons than he is with them. And this was part of the Indo-Pacific strategy that also was declassified, kind of the rationale behind the North Korea approach as well. Of course, there's a whole strategy that underpins that and implementation plans and so forth. But I was afraid that we would repeat the failed cycle of previous efforts to engage the North, right? Which is make big concessions up front. Well, he didn't do that in Singapore. Certainly didn't do that in Hanoi, and that's why that summit failed, which I think was a good thing. Mm-hmm. And then we didn't meet their demands for big payoffs and reliefs of sanctions just for the privilege of talking with them, and then engage in a long drawn out process that results in a weak agreement that they immediately break. The whole effort has been really to not alleviate the pressure on the North until there is irreversible momentum toward denuclearization. Mm-hmm. I think that's still the best shot. And essentially, it's a thesis, right? We're testing a thesis that Kim Jong-un could be convinced that he is safer without the weapons than he is with them. And there's a lot more that can be done. Bill, we didn't really have the kind of sanctions that we have in place now until Nikki Haley did actually a tremendous job in getting those approved by the UN Security Council. And then we just have never really enforced them either. And I'm talking about really enforcement through secondary sanctions, maybe on Chinese financial institutions that are facilitating illicit financial flows and trade above the restrictions in those resolutions. Also the end of really this the North Korea's use of really slave export of slave laborers, right, who send remittances back and is a big source of revenue, for them as well. I think there could be actions we could take in a multinational format to interdict some of the illicit smuggling activity and so forth. But I think it's time to put more pressure on because this threat is grave. And I don't think the old approach, going back to like a multilateral negotiation, I just don't think it's going to work.
HR, why was the Washington foreign policy establishment just so vehemently opposed to this president? And by vehement, I mean just, writing just poison pen columns constantly in the Washington Post and the Atlantic and the New York Times and going on TV and just absolutely dumping on him. Was it personal? They just detested his style. Was it professional? Did they resent not being under the tent? Was it the fact that Trump wasn't an outsider coming in, that he was in some regards on the world stage a bull in a china shop? What really kind of drove the animus?
Yeah, I think it's all of the above, Bill. You know, and I think it's, you know, the I think the you know I think actually, you know, this kind of vitriol is only possible when there is an interaction, right? It's not just one side, right? It's an interaction with between, you know, Donald Trump's personality, right? I mean, he's, you know, he's not a super likable person, right? I mean, you know, in terms of getting to the politics of addition and bringing people into the tent, right?
Thank you for making news today.
his approach is one on doubling down on a relatively narrow political base, right? So he never really got, even though he did appeal to constituencies people thought he wouldn't ever reach, and he did so mainly because he ran against, you know, everything. He ran against the government. He ran against the foreign policy establishment. But you know, really, he took it like he does everything. Like, he took it to an extreme. Right. And then he actually began to operate against his own administration, right? That's really what made a difficult situation, you know, and challenging situation circumstances even more challenging on occasion.
Right.
And you know, I think that, you know, the foreign policy elites and those who really hated Donald Trump hated him for all the reasons you mentioned, and I think what happened is the hatred of Donald Trump really foreclosed on their opportunity for some self-criticism, right, for them to try to understand better, hey, where have we failed? You know, why have so many people lost confidence, right, in, you know, in our political elites? And I think those questions are still largely unanswered, you know, and these are questions I think that have to be asked, I think, within the Republican Party, but I think just broadly across the, you know, the foreign policy and national security establishment.
And does this also apply HR to the world leaders? You looked at the photo ops when Trump would go to a G7 or something like that, and the body language was painful just to see the, especially like the European leaders, just literally cringing being around him.
Well, you know, I'll tell you something about Donald Trump is like he can certainly be offensive, insulting, but he does that mostly in public. I mean, when I've seen him in private with, you know, with world leaders, you know, he actually tends to be, you know, a good host when he's hosting them. He tends to be gracious, engaging, you know. I think some of them enjoyed the fact that, like, he had no filter, right? Bill, I'll tell you, so many times in meetings, I would just think, did he just say that? You know, I think in some ways that was refreshing for some of them, you know, but of course, you know, I think it was the deep skepticism of the NATO alliance and the relationship with the EU and the tendency to see European Union countries mainly as economic competitors rather than allies. I think that's what made that relationship particularly difficult, right? I think that relationship was difficult, but others were actually quite good, right? The relationship with Abe, I think, and Japan was probably, you know, as good as it's ever been, right? So it was mixed, you know, I think that whoever comes in is going to have an opportunity, I think, because, you know, hey, Bill, we're not a monarchy, right? I mean, the American people, America is more than just any one president.
Right.
And I think, you know, the vitriol, the anti-Trump, you know, much of it, understandable, you know, that we've seen in this country, as you know, it's been replicated in Europe, right, almost even to a more intense degree. So I think, you know, President Biden has, you know, he's prioritized, you know, the European relationship. But as you know, as our colleague Neil Ferguson says, you know, hey, it has to be more than about the mood music, right? It has to be about, hey, what are we going to work together on? What is the agenda, you know, for the transatlantic relationships and alliance, and how do we work together to advance our mutual interests, especially in connection, I think, with the competition with an increasingly aggressive Chinese Communist Party.
Yeah, in fact, Biden's first overseas trip, I believe, is going to be in June to the G7 summit in Cornwall. He's not going to do something symbolic as did Obama as did Trump, which I think is kind of sick. Let's talk about Biden in the time remaining on this podcast, HR. I can make the argument to you that on the one hand, he is arguably the most prepared president in modern times when it comes to foreign affairs. Why? He served in the Senate. He chaired the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He was a vice president for 8 years. He's traveled the world stage. He knows world leaders. He is also, by dint of having been in Washington for the better part of a half a century, he's seen nine presidents' HR come and go. He's had a lot of time to see what works and what doesn't work, so he should be, as the cliche goes, ready from day one. On the other hand, I'm going to give you the half-empty side of the glass here. You're an optimist, but we got a little half-empty here. Two things stand out. Number one, this is a recycling president, appears, when it comes to foreign policy. Just look at the hires. He has hired John Kerry. He's hired Wendy Sherman, Samantha Power. Susan Rice is back in the White House, albeit in a domestic policy, capacity, but perhaps he'll pick up the phone and call her and ask her some questions on foreign policy. To use a military thing, he's got a lot of colonels around him, a lot of very familiar colonels. So the question is this, HR, is there a Joe Biden doctrine at this very, very early point in his presidency? Can we look at him as being transformative in any way on foreign policy, or is it going to be redundant? Are we going back to the Obama years?
Yeah. Gosh, I hope it's not redundant, right? So this is why I think we have to kind of suspend judgment. We have to take a look at the policies. I think if you look at and listen to the testimony of yesterday, that's encouraging, right? Because I think that there were elements of continuity associated with China in particular, and the need to be competitive, yes. Take the competitive approach to China. And I think that was heartening, right? This was last time that when Vice President Biden was confronting some of these foreign policy issues as part of the Obama administration,
right.
They had sort of doubled down on kind of an accommodation approach with the Chinese Communist Party. And I think it emboldened the party. It made conflict more, not less likely. And we were extremely vulnerable because we weren't even in the arena of competition with China in key areas. Right. So I think that, I think we should suspend judgment. I would say that I really do believe that the one of the fundamental flaws of the Obama administration's foreign policy is they define their foreign policy mainly as an opposition to the Bush administration's foreign policy.
Right.
And as a result, they made some big errors, and I think if there's a fair criticism of the Bush administration that at times that the administration undervalued or underappreciated the risk and cost of actions, the typical cases, the invasion of Iraq in 2003, that the Obama administration undervalued the risks and costs of inaction and disengagement. I think it's important to remember, right. It was Vice President Biden who called President Obama in December of 2011 from Baghdad and said, "Hey, thank you for allowing me to end this goddamn war." Hey, well, hey, guess what? Wars don't end when one side disengages. And we found that out in an inescapable manner when ISIS was in control of territory the size of Great Britain by 2014. So, I think that I believe that people have the ability to learn.
Yes.
I think these are smart people who understand it's not 2016 anymore. Mm-hmm. And so I think we should suspend judgment, be supportive. We should all be in this together. I hope, Bill, that you just listened to the inauguration speech, as did I. And I hope that this theme of bringing Americans together to try to build a higher degree of consensus maybe can begin in the area of foreign policy, which, as you mentioned, was largely neglected, during the presidential campaign.
Right. So let me throw a golfing analogy at you, HR. Let's make you Joe Biden's caddy, and Joe Biden has to play 18 holes of golf. I want you to take him to two holes in particular, the hole that on the flag has Iran written on it and the hole that has on its flag China written on it. And I want you to tell me, as a caddy to Joe Biden, how do you avoid the sand traps and the water hazards and the roughs of those two particles? So let's start with Iran, then we'll go to China. And you've written a piece for the Washington Post on China, so we'll get to that next. So start with Iran. What mistakes does he need to avoid with regard to Iran?
Well, I think the main mistake is to not consider really two fundamental conditions of the U.S.-Iran relationship. And the first of these is the ideology that drives and constrains the Iranian leadership, and in particular, the Supreme Leader and the Guardian Council, and to recognize that President Rouhani, who doesn't have much time left, and Zarif, the foreign minister, these aren't the real decision makers. This is the shop window, that Iran puts forward. And it still is the ideology of the revolution that drives the leadership. So, a lot of the corollaries to that, like, don't trust them, right? And recognize that they are that the revolutionaries there who have won and are in control of the government are permanently hostile to the United States, Israel, and the Arab monarchies. And then second is to consider our approach to Iran in context of the four-decade-long proxy war that they've been fighting against us. And so I think if you consider those two fundamental conditions of the relationship, you can make wise decisions and go into negotiations, for example, with your eyes open.
Okay. And let's then so that's, go ahead. And let's talk about China now. You wrote a piece for the Washington Post, and if I can distill it to three words, those three words would be keep the course.
Yeah, keep the course, or maybe four words, you know, don't fall for it. Right. And it being
okay. What is it?
It is the Chinese Communist Party's promises of cooperation, right? Cooperation on climate change, for example, as they're building 70 coal-fired plants a year, you know, right. and not only in China, but in Africa, where they just completed, you know, the largest carbon emitting facility in Kenya, right next to a UNESCO World Heritage Site, right? So, I mean, you have to not believe that. I think, and then also maybe for you know the promise of cooperation on denuclearization of North Korea and the Korean Peninsula. So, I mean, I think that what they hope for in exchange is an alleviation of pressure, right? To maybe start selling them chips again, you know, or to lift restrictions on Huawei and to not oppose Huawei's effort to put in global communications infrastructure. With a pipeline directly back to Beijing, right. For all the data that they're going to gain access to. So I think, you know, don't fall for it. Would be it for China, and then for Iran, it's really recognize the nature of the regime and make sure you keep it, the historical context of four decades of a proxy war that they've waged against us, really. And I think until the Soleimani killing, you know, there was all this discussion about, oh, that's escalatory. No, I mean, you know, Iran has escalated that proxy war at will right. and done so really without ever suffering consequences. I mean, Bill, I think it's important for us to remember, you know, Iranian proxies killed 600 of our soldiers in Iraq. During the Iraq War, and so we just have to go into both of these competitions with a hostile state and with a strategic rival with our eyes open.
Why did the Trump administration wait until the last day in office, HR, to come out and do what it did with regard to the Uyghurs?
Yeah, I don't know, Bill. I think part of it maybe is that more and more is coming to light. You know, China has been engaged in this building this firewall, the Great Firewall, higher and higher. It's expelled international journalists. There's been some really good reporting, investigative journalist reporting, you know, from the New York Times and others, you know, who've gotten people in, and there have been some really courageous people who have been subjected to these concentration camps and re-education and forced labor who've smuggled their stories out. Some of them have paid the price for doing so.
Right.
But I think more and more of it's coming to light now. It's really inescapable. I think it's important to have been done. I wish it had been done sooner, actually, mm-hmm. but I'm glad it's done. And I think when I heard, you know, Tony Blinken's testimony yesterday, it was great to hear how strong he was on it. And of course, you know, I think as we prioritize a relationship with the European Union and European Union countries, hey, why don't we ask them, hey, let's get a little backbone here now with China instead of entering into this trade deal, which still hasn't passed the European Parliament. But I do hope that we engage, you know, our European friends on this. And I think, you know, on China, if the US, the EU, and now Britain as well, and then Japan work together, right, and pull others into the effort, you know, India and others, it's really going to be hard for China to take the approach they've been taking, which is a divide and conquer approach, this approach of co-option, coercion, and concealment.
Right. And what about Russia, HR? We're not going to see another clock delivered to the Russian foreign minister with a Peregruska written on it, which means reset in Russian. How do you think Biden's going to approach Putin?
Yeah, I think he's going to have a tough approach to Putin and to the Kremlin's aggressive action. But you know what's paradoxical about this, Bill, and I think little understood, is the Trump administration's strategy on Russia, as implemented, was actually quite strong in terms of imposing costs on not just, you know, Vladimir Putin, but the oligarchs who surround him. Right. And this is in response, obviously, to the follow up. To the sanctions put on Russia from the invasion of Ukraine and the annexation of Crimea, but then carrying on into the Trump administration, you know, my last really substantive meeting in the Oval Office was teeing up the options for President Trump after the Skripal poisoning in Salisbury, England. And you know, he took a pretty tough approach there, right? Expelled over 60 undeclared Russian intelligence agents, closed the Russian consulate in San Francisco, which was very important to them as an intelligence collection platform, mainly oriented on us here in Silicon Valley. Right. And you know, and so I think that in actual implementation, the Biden approach will be one of continuity. What we won't have is with President Biden is the space that President Trump gave to Putin, you know, by not acknowledging, you know, his disruptive behavior and his aggression against us, right?
Right.
And you know, I describing battlegrounds, you know, the approach that Russia takes is one of disruption, disinformation, and denial. Mm-hmm. And with Putin, all he goes after what my British counterpart Mark Sedwell would call it, implausible deniability, right? He'll just say, "Oh, I didn't poison him," and maybe Navalny poisoned himself, right? I mean, sadly, President Trump oftentimes made it too easy for Putin to make these ridiculous claims in an effort to still, you know, get away with murder, literally.
Poison himself. You know, smart people don't sit down and chug Tide Pods. It's kind of rule in life. Let's talk about an aspect of foreign policy, HR, which is the projection of strength. And this is something Democratic presidencies have struggled with, well, since the death of John Kennedy and the Lyndon Johnson experience in Vietnam. Jimmy Carter struggled with this. Bill Clinton struggled with this. Barack Obama struggled with it. The Obama approach being what? There's not a problem that a cruise missile can't solve from a very long distance. The Trump approach was kind of interesting, HR, in this regard. It struck me as kind of a hybrid, if you will. On the one hand, this is a president who was not averse to the use of force. I mean, witness the death of Soleimani, you know, just a very, you know, shock and awe kind of event. On the other hand, he was very much against the idea of boots on the ground. So you look at the Biden approach. Do you think we're going back to cruise missile diplomacy, or do you think Biden might be a little more hawkish than we might expect?
You know, I don't really know, Bill. I know that, you know, the President Biden, both in Afghanistan and in Iraq, had really advocated for, you know, a very light military footprint and what some people call a counterterrorism strategy, right?
Right.
A counterterrorism only strategy. The problem is that doesn't work, right? That's the Bill Clinton approach from 98, where you just fire a few cruise missiles at Al-Qaeda and call it a day, right? Well, that didn't work out well for us after the most devastating terrorist attack in history at 9/11. And I hope what the Biden administration will recognize is that our sustained engagement with relatively small numbers of troops enables others to bear the brunt of the fight against these enemies of all humanity. And I think it's worth noting, you know, that whereas every U.S. casualty is, you know, is a tragedy for us and certainly for, you know, those families who lose loved ones or courageous, you know, men and women who are, you know, who are fighting in our name. And to defend our country, that it is the Afghans, and it is the you know, the Iraqis and the Syrian Defense Forces and the Somali, you know, forces who are bearing the brunt of the fight against these enemies. And so I hope that there is a sustained commitment and recognition, you know, this is essentially an insurance policy that we have to that is going to require, you know, a sustained commitment, but at a cost that's acceptable to the American people. What I hope President Biden will do is do a much better job at explaining to the American people what they deserve to know about our military commitments abroad. And that is, hey, what is at stake? You know, what is at stake in terms of our interests, our security? And then what is the strategy? What is the strategy, not just based on military action, but based on the integration of all elements of our national power and efforts of like-minded partners that get us to an outcome that is worthy of the costs and the sacrifices that we're making.
So there's another way to pose this question, HR. In Battlegrounds, you write about going to Beijing with the president, and you write about sitting down with your Chinese counterparts, and you try to put in very plain terms saying that, look at what you're doing in the South China Sea, the provocative acts you're doing, this is going to come to a very bad conclusion sooner or later, so you've got to stop this. Can you see the Biden administration, HR, being as blunt, or are we going back to the idea that we can sit down and rationalize them? Because this gets back to the whole idea of what is Chinese communism. Yeah, they're communists, but really in their hearts, they're capitalist. We can talk to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they will, and I think the reason why I think they're going to have these tough conversations is because of the full range of actions that the party's taken. Mm-hmm. It's really almost inescapable. I mean, I think the main cause of what will be, I think, a determined foreign policy and a competitive approach to China will be Xi Jinping, right? So I just don't think he's going to provide much room for us to do otherwise. And I think that the next year, between now and the Winter Olympics, right, that China is hosting, is going to be a period of increasing danger. I think of confrontation, especially maybe with Taiwan as the biggest flashpoint, or in the South China Sea, as you mentioned. But after those Olympics and after the Chinese Communist Party Congress in 2022,
right,
I think that's going to be a period of even greater danger of confrontation. So how do we reduce the danger of that? I think it's making it clear to the party that they can't accomplish their objectives through the use of force. Mm-hmm. That it is in China's interests, to play by the rules and to stop the various forms of economic and cyber aggression that we've experienced. And to do so with like-minded partners, to galvanize them. I think that's the right approach to convince the Chinese Communist Party that they can have enough of their dream without pursuing that dream at the expense of their own people and without extinguishing the rights of the Chinese people. And then, of course, they can accomplish enough without doing so at our expense, right? And hey, will that get through to Xi Jinping? I don't know. I think that, as I write in the book, that he is driven by emotion and aspiration. He's driven by fear of losing the control, losing the party's exclusive grip on power. And he's driven by this ambition to realize the China dream, to take center stage in the world. And this is why we're seeing them become much more aggressive, at exporting their authoritarian mercantilist model.
Right. So final question, HR. So in the Trump foreign policy apparatus, we had what? We had the president who would make phone calls. So he, for example, he had a good relationship, you mentioned, with Abe. They connected. They connected in terms of common concerns in East Asia. They connected over Gulf. They bonded. You had Mike Pompeo, who is a very active globetrotting Secretary of State. You had Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, who is very active, very involved in the Abraham Accords, for example. How do you see the Biden foreign policy apparatus working? Because, as I mentioned, you have a president who knows the world and has a lot of relationships, so he might be very apt to pick up and call. Tony Blinken is the new Secretary of State. He will be when he's confirmed. You have a former Secretary of State in John Kerry, who is in charge of climate change and is, I think, actually has a seat at NSC meetings now as part of the deal he cut. You have a woman in Susan Rice who wanted to be the Secretary of State, and she's floating around the White House as kind of a minister without a portfolio. You have these other people I mentioned who are, former Obama people, Harvard Kennedy School likes. A lot of people with opinions, a lot of people used to being in the news, a lot of people who might think they're the voice. How does the president organize this? How does he make sure that he is the general and everybody else reports to him?
Yeah. Well, I think the best way to do it is for the National Security Advisor to run an effective, transparent, collaborative process, mm-hmm. and to ask others, to buy in and support that process. I think that the emphasis has to be on that process, delivering multiple options to the president. So the president can determine his own agenda and make decisions consistent with his agenda, right? Because people have to remember, I think, those who are appointed, are not accountable to the American people, right? I mean, the person who got elected is the president, and the vice president, right? And so, it is not the job, a national security advisor or one cabinet official to make policy, right? That's the president's, it's in the president's purview. Now, of course, the Secretary of State is the lead, on foreign policy, development of those options. The National Security Advisor and the National Security Council staff should work very closely and collaboratively with the policy planning team and state to tee up, kind of the framing of the challenges that we're facing and the policies policy options designed to overcome those challenges and take advantage of opportunities. So, hey, I hope that they work well together. There is. It's not unprecedented that there's tension in these relationships. I experienced a good bit of it myself. but I think, as a national security advisor, when you encounter those tensions, right. Then you face a choice, a fundamental choice. You could either become, very closed off, right? and then kind of run a process that is not collaborative, you know, that is not transparent, or you can just become more transparent. And I think what you know, at least what I tried to do is to demonstrate that we were, you know, should be a trusted organization that was running a collaborative process, right? We weren't cooking stuff up on our own. We were working with the departments and agencies because, you know, it's the departments and agencies they're going to have to implement, right? So they ought to be in on the framing. And I would say it's the same thing with allies and partners as well. You know, Bill, you mentioned the president's engagements and phone calls and so forth. And, you know, I think it's really important for us to frame these complex challenges we're facing together, right? To try to understand them together. Right. And there are certain formats that are conducive to that. You know, the Quint format is one of them, you know, with the US, UK, Germany, Italy, and France. But there should be kind of bespoke collaborative venues that I think help us, you know, understand how we can work together, what our competitive advantages are, and how we apply those competitive advantages in a synergistic way, multinationally, where our interests are aligned.
I'm looking at my copy of Battlegrounds right now, HR, and is there a sequel in the works?
Well, there is. I'm working on a book, and I've got to get to it, Bill. You know,
we're ending the podcast. Don't worry.
I need to do a little less talking, a little more writing these days, But I hope to write something that will explain better, you know, the nature of the national security decision making and foreign policy development process, right. and the role, you know, that process plays, as well as the role of personalities and relationships and so forth. So I'm still kind of outlining and starting a little bit of writing now, but
so it sounds like you're aiming for the professorial and not the personal.
You know, probably a little bit of both, right? Because, you know, I do think obviously character and personality and relationships have a profound influence, right, on the course of events, on decisions that are made and policies that are and how they're implemented. I want it to be something that, you know, that is of use to, you know, to future, you know, those who take on these problems in the future or have these responsibilities in the future. As I mentioned, I was very grateful for the opportunity to have conducted research and written about, you know, national security decision making from a historical perspective before taking on the job.
Yeah. And, you know, if you talk about wanting to heal the country and get Washington to work better, I think one of the ways to do that, HR, is fewer people should be taking seven-figure contracts to write tell-all books.
Yeah.
No, it was just, well, you know, just the grinding of axes.
Yeah, trust is important, right? I mean, you know, as I mentioned, for a national security advisor in particular, you know, you're the only person who has the president as his or her only client. And what I'm concerned about these days, right, is like, gosh, you know, who's a president going to trust, right? Who's a president going to blow off steam with, you know, or think out loud, right? If everybody's taking it down and is going to use it against him or her later.
Well, that's what's going to be interesting about this presidency. We will wrap up here in a second because I know you've got other work to do. I don't think you're going to see the splashy book contracts as you do with Trump because, frankly, Joe Biden books aren't going to sell. But there is a tendency for people to want to, you know, either talk to reporters off the record or, you know, leave in a huff and write the obligatory nobody listened to me book. So that's one curious thing to watch about Biden, especially the foreign policy apparatus. If anybody comes out of that shop just kind of disgruntled and complaining about how things are run.
Right, right, and you know, I think this, you know, this tendency lately to just leak stuff to the press constantly, you know, and of course it's all for an agenda, right? And this is disruptive, you know, and I hope that, you know, that those who are on the National Security Council staff certainly, and those who are coming into the administration, you know, recognize that it's their job to serve the president, the elected president, and the Constitution and the American people. Not themselves by, you know, having cozy relationships with, you know, with journalists and to make themselves feel important because they're leaking, you know, sensitive information. I hope that sense of responsibility is carried into the administration by those who are joining it.
Okay. HR, enjoyed the conversation. And this is a rough day for you because in a few hours you get to have to deal with me again on the Goodfellas broadcast.
But and maybe I'll slack a little bit, let Cochran and Ferguson take the take center stage there.
Well, they're satisfied with their opinions. So. Well, anyway, HR, thank you for taking part in this, the last Area 45 podcast. But be warned, this will come back under a new title. I'll be bugging you again at some point to come on. Always enjoy a conversation. It's a real honor and just pleasure to have you as a colleague at the Hoover Institution. You're a tremendous asset for us.
No, hey, Bill, the feeling's mutual. What a privilege it is to be with you. Thank you so much.
Okay, you take care, HR. You've been listening to the final edition of Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the politics and policy during the time of the 45th President of the United States. If you like this podcast and are hungry for more, we cover the waterfront at the Hoover Institution podcast on economics, foreign policy, law, education, libertarianism. I think H.R. McMaster's Battlegrounds interviews get converted to audio, so that's good for a power walk. Yeah. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. Click on the publications tab and you'll see a link to those podcasts. While you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for Hoover's Daily Report, which delivers the best work of H.R. McMaster and his colleagues to your inbox every weekday. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is at Hoover Inst. H.R. McMaster finally gave in to the inevitable. He went to the dark side. He is on Twitter. His Twitter handle is at LTGHRMcMaster. Let me repeat that, at LTGHRMcMaster. McMaster spelled as you might expect, M-C-M-A-S-T-E-R. Anything else I need to plug for you, H.R.?
Oh, I appreciate it, Bill. Thank you.
For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with more podcasts, new name, a new year, lots to talk about. Till then, take care. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.